Lecture 15, Converts to Espionage.
Let me start with a really difficult question. Should spies be given Christmas presents? In 1936, in New York City, two spies were arguing about motivation. Why would someone spy? Why would someone take on the dangers and risks of spying? One of the spies having this conversation was a Soviet agent, a Soviet handler of American spies, Colonel Boris Bykov. The other person with whom he was having a conversation was an American communist spying for the Soviets. He was a courier for the underground, and he was known by many pseudonyms, among them Carl. So let's call him Carl. Christmas and the holiday season were approaching, and Bykov insisted to Carl that the best agents who were working with Carl needed to be given money as a present. I mean, all of this ignored the truly bizarre strangeness of communist spies trying to mark a religious holiday of Christmas. When he heard this, Carl erupted, and he said, "Money? They would be outraged. You don't understand. They're communists on principle. If you offer them money, they'll never trust you again." Bykov disagreed, and he cynically delivered a maxim. He told Carl, "The person who pays is the boss, and the person who takes the money must deliver." Some big present, Boris argued, had to be made so that the spies would know that their handlers are big, important people. And so Bykov, over the protests of Carl, decided on purchasing a number of very expensive and flashy Oriental rugs, which were to be given to the American agents as the gifts of a grateful Soviet people, reward for their services. Afterwards, the man called Carl had to admit that he'd been wrong. Almost all the agents who got these gifts were impressed and grateful, not revolted on ideological grounds. In the interwar period of crisis, that period of radical challenge that we talked about in our last lecture, individuals could choose to commit themselves to espionage. This included the Cambridge spy ring in Britain or Soviet spies in the United States. And this choice could show the power of ideology and personal factors. In this lecture, we'll consider a series of spies and ask about their motivations. And I think personally, this makes this one of the most interesting of the topics that we broach in this lecture series, because it's all about the individual. We've talked in earlier lectures about spy masters, about organizational structure, about political leaders who use spies. In this case, we'll actually focus on individual personalities, and that's tremendously rewarding. The Cambridge spy ring was made up of British undergraduates who were recruited into Soviet spying while still quite young in the 1930s. And they would play long-term significant roles up into the Cold War when they were finally unmasked. So let's ask, were their motives personal, political, both, or something else? The spy ring included Kim Philby, Anthony Blunt, Guy Burgess, Donald McLean, and John Carencross. Of these, Kim Philby has been called the greatest spy of modern times. Some claim him as the greatest spy of all times. And he earns this reputation by virtue of his long record of betrayal from positions of high authority. We'll follow Philby's trail in later lectures, but what makes his case so interesting here is that decades afterwards, when Philby fled to Moscow in 1963 to avoid being arrested by the British, he then wrote and was allowed in 1968 by the KGB to publish a memoir of his activities, My Silent War. While we need to read this document critically, it provides a very rare historical moment when a spy, in this case a double agent, reveals, or seems to reveal, aspects of what drove him to this work. And for that reason, I very much recommend that if you're interested, that you read this brief but very intriguing book. Most of the five of the Cambridge spies came from comfortable backgrounds, from wealthy, socially prominent British families. the exception or the contrast was Karen Cross, who came from a poorer Scottish background. Cambridge was the elite university where the future leaders of Britain and its empire were to be educated and trained for their future roles. Many of the five would end up rebelling against their family background of privilege, rebelling against the expectations of being leaders of British society by instead working for communism. There were other factors that also apparently bound these men together, aspects of the culture of British universities at the time. This included heavy drinking. In some of their cases, it also included homosexuality or bisexuality, so that some of them were romantically linked with one another. Blunt and Burgess were also members of the Apostles' Student Society, which was a secretive Cambridge discussion group of a dozen or so undergraduates who saw themselves as an unconventional elite. The other unifying factor of the Cambridge spy ring was leftist politics, a rejection of the traditional parties and the traditional way of doing things in the atmosphere of crisis of the 1930s. It seemed that emergency called for new ways of doing things. Many contemporaries at the time, beyond just the circle of these spies, talked of their deep disillusionment, a sense in which the world no longer seemed to work or cohere. Older values seemed decayed and seemed to have lost their claims to transcendent meaning. The British novelist E.M. Forster famously said that if faced with the choice of betraying his country or betraying a friend, he truly hoped that in such a situation he would have the courage to betray his country. Now, Forster may have been trying on an idea, but such sentiments were in the air at the time. They were echoed in the famous Oxford Union debate of February 9, 1933, in which a large majority of students at Oxford's famous debating club voted for the resolution that this House will in no circumstances fight for its king and country. In fact, many undergraduates, and probably many who had voted for the motion, did in fact volunteer when World War II came 6 years later. In 1934, the Peace Pledge Union was founded in Britain with 9 million people subscribing to its determination to prevent a new war. This is how traumatic the experience of the First World War had been. But the members of the Cambridge spy ring went beyond all this. They were more ardent in their fervor, determined to do something really radical and decisive. The Cambridge spy ring's members were turned towards communism and the Soviet Union as the incarnation of progress, in part through the activities of two talent spotters for Soviet intelligence who were on the Cambridge campus, Arnold Deutsch, a communist from Austria, and Theodor Mali, a Hungarian former Catholic priest who put them in touch with the Soviet authorities. What motivated these British students? They apparently refused to accept money for their services. Later, when Anthony Blunt, who was unmasked decades later as a spy, was interrogated by the British Secret Service, he had just one pithy statement that he felt summed it all up. He replied to his interrogators, "You don't understand the 1930s. The implication here was that there was something in the air at the time. There was something of the spirit of the age that was relevant to the choices they made. As we'd already mentioned, the group was also bound together by friendship or sex as well. It's intriguing to note that this was a violation of tradecraft. Classical tradecraft usually urges that a spy ring have members who are kept remote from one another and not be involved in relationships with one another so that the ring could not be easily penetrated and broken and arrested en masse. Graham Greene, the British spy and later spy novelist, whom we'll discuss in Lecture 21, thought he had an answer as to what motivated the Cambridge spies. He compared them to early Jesuits, holding fast to their faith, and whether that faith was right or wrong, true or false, mattered less than their devotion. That's Greene's perspective. Let's look at Kim Philby more closely. As he was originally named, Harold Philby was born to a distinguished British family. His father was a civil servant in the administration of India. His father was also a noted explorer and later became a convert to Islam. Philby came to be known as Kim, as we'd mentioned already, after the hero of Rudyard Kipling's novel by that name. Like his father, Kim Philby had many affairs with women and four marriages. His contemporaries record that he had immense charm, lots of energy, tremendous intelligence, and like his father, a yearning for adventure, a lot like the Kim of the novel. In 1929, Philby had gone to Trinity College at Cambridge, and there was recruited by the Soviets. And he was given a specific task, the assignment of infiltrating British intelligence. Why did he join the Soviet effort? In that memoir published in 1968, My Silent War, Philby speaks of having made a total commitment to the Soviet Union, which, quote, I regarded then, as I do now, as the inner fortress of the world movement, end quote. Philby continues in his account that his decision was not the result of a sudden conversion, not the result of one blinding flash, but rather a slower process, one that combined disillusionment with a new faith. Philby records that he'd been upset by the defeat of the Labour Party in Britain in 1931. He saw this election defeat at the ballot box as an indictment of democracy. Democracy, it seemed to him, was not capable of solving its very own problems. And so Philby looked for alternatives. Over the next 2 years, Philby records that he moved towards communism and ultimately left the university with a degree, and more important, with a conviction that, quote, my life must be devoted to communism, end quote, a new faith. Philby explained, moreover, and I think this is especially telling, that he had made a decision to join the winning side, the side that owned the future, the side that was going to triumph historically. Philby also added, very revealingly, that further he was entranced at the very prospect of being offered enrollment in an elite force. Being a member of an elite promised a special role, promised a meaningful activity abroad in the world. And armed with this self-confidence, Philby went off on a mission to Spain. Spain at this point was racked by the Spanish Civil War, which we'll discuss in our next lecture. In Spain, as a Soviet agent, Philby used the cover of being a newspaper reporter. In his memoir, Kim Philby very tellingly skims over an event that happened in 1939. And this is what I meant earlier by our having to be quite careful and critical in our reading of this memoir. He skims over what appears to have been a personal crisis of confidence that he had in his new faith when he had heard of the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany signing the Nazi-Soviet Pact in 1939. Other sources, not in his memoir, My Silent War, suggest that Philby apparently dropped out of sight for quite a while from his Soviet handlers. He simply disappeared. And one conclusion that some interpreters have drawn is that he was disgusted by the flexibility or cynicism shown by the Nazi-Soviet Pact and simply had abandoned his earlier role. But then in 1941, the Soviets reestablished contact with Kim Philby, and he returned to his work. And we'll follow more of Philby's activities in lectures 17 and 18, so stay tuned for those. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, another figure was being recruited at this time for Soviet service who, just like Philby, would also leave a remarkable written testimony and who would reappear later in the hunt for spies after the Second World War, in the Hiss case, which we'll discuss in detail in Lecture 18. This was the man that we started the lecture with, a man named Carl, in our opening story. Carl, in quotation marks, was in fact Whitaker Chambers. Whitaker Chambers wrote a compelling book called Witness, written after he had had a political conversion away from his earlier communist faith, and it was published in 1952 to explain himself. We also have to read this book critically, just like that of Philby, because it doesn't contain all the aspects of his life. But let me tell you some of his background. Born in Philadelphia in 1901 with the name J. Vivian Chambers, later changed to Whitaker Chambers, he attended Columbia University in New York as an undergraduate, but did not finish. He was forced to leave that institution when he wrote a scandalous bohemian play that outraged university authorities. In 1925, Whitaker Chambers joined the Communist Party of the United States of America. About 1931, he deepened his commitment to that cause by going underground to become a secret courier for the Soviets. Chambers operated from Baltimore, passing U.S. government documents that he received from other agents on to a Soviet handler. Chambers was one of a number of agents who had been recruited into Soviet networks. The recruitment effort of the Soviets had begun in earnest in America in 1934, and it centered on Washington, D.C. It also had other strong points in New York and in San Francisco, but D.C. was really the heart. In what was considered a trademark or a characteristic aspect of the Soviet approach towards intelligence, you see that different intelligence agencies have their distinctive styles as well. Their style was that important tasks were often given to so-called illegals or illegal agents in the United States. What's meant by an illegal agent in tradecraft? Well, agents who are, let's say, military attachés or who are diplomats have diplomatic cover because they work out of an embassy, and thus they have diplomatic immunity. If they're captured, the worst that will happen to them is that they'll be shipped back to their country as people who are not desired in the host country. Illegals, by contrast, are agents who don't have diplomatic cover. In this case, they work alone, and if they're caught, their home government will disavow any knowledge of them. Such illegals were infiltrated into the United States to work for the Soviet side. The priorities assigned to the spy networks of the Soviets in the United States included economic and military espionage. The most effective and committed of those spies were those who had ideological faith in the cause that the Soviet Union represented. But not all of them, as we'll see, kept that faith. For instance, from around 1937, Whitaker Chambers was left badly shaken. The news of the Stalinist purges that were decimating even the ranks of the old believers, the true party activists who had helped forge the Bolshevik Revolution under Stalin, left Chambers deeply disturbed and disillusioned. He, moreover, slowly began to turn towards a faith in God as a counterpoise to his earlier ideological certainties. Just after the Nazi-Soviet Pact was announced in 1939, Chambers felt that he was ready for another decisive move, a reconversion. He went to the American authorities to reveal all. In particular, he went to the United States Assistant Secretary of State, Adolph Burl, and handed him the disturbing news that one of his subordinates, Alger Hiss, according to Whitaker Chambers, was a spy. Burl refused to believe this, and nothing happened. Years later, however, after the Second World War, in 1948, this case would come to life again, and we'll trace that in Lecture 18. Let's ask now, what impelled Whitaker Chambers to become a spy? In a word, his communist convictions. In his memoir, Witness, Chambers explained that, quote, "I was one of those drawn to communism by the problem of the war," end quote. That's to say, the intense damage and suffering of World War I. In 1923, Whitaker Chambers had traveled to Europe and had seen the dislocation, the turmoil, and the devastation, not just physically, but socially, in Europe firsthand. And this to him was a shattering experience. Because what contemporaries called the Great War of 1914 to 1918 had seemed to him, as it did to many others, to entirely discredit Western civilization. And perhaps the only real alternative might be communism. Chambers wrote afterwards, after he was disillusioned with communism, that, quote, "The revolution is never stronger than the failure of civilization. Communism is never stronger than the failure of other faiths. It is the crisis that makes men communists, end quote. Communism seemed to Chambers the answer for a dying world. And in almost religious terms, Chambers described communism as a faith and a vision, something for which to live and something for which one could die. As a communist, a man dedicated to directing history, hurrying it along in the directions it was supposed to go, Chambers accepted underground work for the party and became a spy. He was exhilarated, just like Kim Philby, at the thought of being chosen for an elite. Once enrolled in this work, Chambers, however, was disturbed that money was thrust at him, even though he didn't want it, by his superiors. A superior had told him that giving money obligates people. Chambers was also instructed in tradecraft, how to set up meetings, to assume all phones were bugged, never to drink because it made you careless, and the routine of a safe house in Greenwich Village in New York with microfilm equipment and spies to help in the transmission of those records. For meetings with his handlers, Chambers became used to wild chases through Manhattan, jumping off of subway cars, and doubling back in order to avoid any followers. Only slowly was it revealed to Chambers who his real superiors were, Soviet military intelligence. Chambers emphasized in his memoir that the work of the spy is not thrilling. Excitement means that something has gone wrong. And also, he understood, or was given to understand, that there was no escape from this new role. A comrade told him, "You can only leave if they shoot you or if we shoot you." When Chambers did leave, breaking with communism, he later described his move in these dark terms, quote, "I know I'm leaving the winning side for the losing side, but it is better to die on the losing side than to live under communism," end quote. For him, this choice was a direct and despairing contrast to Philby's statement that he was joining the side that would win the future. In the motivations of both men, history with a capital H loomed over the decisions they made. In this same period of growing international crisis, others made different choices. Let me present two other examples. For symmetry's sake, one of an American spy for the Nazis and the other a German spy for the Americans. First, Tyler G. Kent was the son of an American diplomat. He had been born in Manchuria, where his father was a consul at the time. Kent had a distinguished academic career. He graduated from Princeton and studied at the Sorbonne in Paris. He did seem destined for some high position in the State Department. But there must have been some dimensions in his character that led to very negative evaluations when he tried for a formal post. He was recorded as being unreliable, judged neurotic, and those who knew him afterwards said that he was an open and rabid anti-Semite. Finally, Kent did manage, probably through influence, to gain a low post at the State Department as an office staffer. After the Soviet Union and the United States began diplomatic relations in 1933, Kent was a code clerk in the new American embassy in Moscow. While in Moscow, he may have been blackmailed by Soviet intelligence in what's called in tradecraft a honeypot operation, the use of sex to lure agents to one's side. A beautiful Russian actress was in the habit of inviting young staffers from the American embassy to come to her dacha, her summer home, for parties, and afterwards would succeed in compromising or blackmailing some of them. In October 1939, Kent was transferred to the American embassy in London, where the American ambassador at the time was Joseph Kennedy. Kennedy, father of the future president, John F. Kennedy, had some pretty firm opinions about the international situation. Germany, he thought, was on the rise, and in the long term, Britain would not be able to hold out. The United States should stick to neutrality and eventually come to some understanding with the rise in Germany. For his part, Kent agreed with his boss. He was a fervent isolationist. Kent seemed a devoted code clerk staying on the job on weekends. In fact, what he was doing was holding back copies of communications that passed through the embassy's coded channels. He held on to telegrams between FDR and Winston Churchill, who at this point was First Lord of the Admiralty, but very soon, in May of 1940, would become Prime Minister of Britain. In these telegrams, FDR and Churchill, while the United States was still formally neutral, were working out arrangements so that the British blockade of Germany would not lead to any incident with American shipping, And they also made arrangements to share information on German submarine sightings in the Atlantic. This didn't violate neutrality's law, but moved away from neutrality in spirit. Kent hoped to pass these communications he'd held on to isolationist politicians in the United States who could use them to damage FDR in public debate about international relations. Once Kent arrived at his new post in London, he started keeping some very strange company. Agents of Scotland Yard observed him meeting with a suspected German spy, and members of the so-called Right Club, which British intelligence described as anti-Semitic and pro-German. And he also met with Russian émigrés. The Russian émigré community in London was diverse. Among them were some whom the British suspected were spying for the Soviets. Remember the convoluted machinations of the trust that had been run by the Bolsheviks earlier in their regime. Another Russian was Anna Volkov, daughter of a Tsarist admiral in exile, who had ties with Nazi Germany. The counterintelligence organization MI5 arrested Kent on May 20, 1940, and found in his apartment over 1,500 embassy papers, along with Kent's pajama-clad girlfriend. When he was informed of the arrest, the U.S. Ambassador Kennedy waived Kent's diplomatic immunity, and Kent was put on trial in Britain in the Old Bailey, the criminal court in London, and found guilty. He was imprisoned for the rest of the Second World War. Incidentally, this security leak embarrassed Ambassador Kennedy. It had happened on his watch, and he later resigned as American-British cooperation grew closer, even before America formally entered World War II, in December of 1941. Finally, let's consider the case of a German-American, William Sebold, originally Wilhelm Sebold. Sebold had been born in Mülheim, Germany. He had fought for Germany in the First World War, but then had emigrated to the United States after the war in 1921, and he'd gotten a good job as an airplane mechanic and became an American citizen in 1936. In February of 1939, before the Second World War broke out, Sebold traveled back to Germany to see relatives who he'd not seen for a while. As soon as he arrived in Germany, he was approached by German military intelligence agents. Sebold was afraid. When they propositioned him to become an agent for Germany, he feared that his relatives in Germany might be harmed if he did not agree to spy. This was made clear to him by implication. And so he gave in to the blackmail. He agreed to spy for Germany. But then he also did something that his new employers did not know about. He visited the American consulate in Cologne, allegedly to get a replacement passport for one that he had lost. And there he spilled the beans. He told the American consular officials about having been recruited by the German Secret Service. Sebold was told by the American officials to play along, and he did so. He was moved to Hamburg, and he took classes at espionage school on how to encrypt messages, how to make microfilms, how to direct radio broadcasts. And then he returned to the United States. Once there, Sebold set up a spy ring with a lot of friendly help from the FBI that knew all about this secretly. The spy ring even had an office with excellent location in terms of real estate on Times Square in New York City. And it became the clearinghouse for radio transmissions from Nazi spies in the United States. This was actually also a violation of tradecraft. Remember that in tradecraft, it's best to have duplicates or many redundant channels of communication. In this case, Sebold convinced his handlers that he should be the one through whom all of their communications to America was channeled. And this put him in a really good position to betray them. When the FBI finally decided to shut this operation down in 1941, they netted around 37 Nazi spies using the information of Sebold. Sebold then disappeared, having been given a new identity, and was never heard from again. In these cases, which all speak to motivation, we see, I think, one of the reasons why the topic of this course is just so fascinating and intriguing for us, the hidden world of espionage, because the motivations for spying include all of the drama that human character and values are capable of producing. Motivations for spying included true faith in ideology, even if it was faith in terrible causes, the lure of financial reward, the threat of blackmail of several kinds, fear for oneself or the safety of relatives, deep personal psychological motives of rebellion, rejection of one's parents' values, the satisfaction of feeling that one was part of a chosen elite. The secret world of espionage, I think, seems so fascinating because it's a distilled, concentrated version of factors that are at work in all of our lives. We can identify with some of its quandaries and drama. All the human drama this presented would be concentrated even further and given focus in the greatest armed conflict in human history to date, the Second World War, and we'll consider its outbreak in our next lecture.